and instantly be put on Free Radio Santa Cruz because you didn't say not for broadcast. Now back to the program.
And the why? And ain't a sucker for too many lies. You will see that Babylon is too corrupt. Let it fall.
Let it fall.
Let it fall.
Let it fall.
It's too corrupt.
Too corrupt.
Five years after the uprising of 65, the same streets were on fire.
Coming up next, Bathurst Spears Broadsides, the November 18th, 2001 edition, 2.5 hours of civil rights on the streets, with a special report from activist Becky Johnson on the Dolphin Lee Demolition Project, the city's special grant of money to Mercy Charities Housing to produce less housing, less affordable housing that's currently in the beach flats in the area that they're working, resulting in destruction of a community. Camp Paradise updates. Santa Cruz. Hopefully a little warmth against the rains and the winter cold if they don't catch you doing camping. You know, camping is illegal here. Even life-sustaining camping, even camping that involves no fires, just simply sleeping in a sleeping bag after 11 o'clock at night. That is called camping in Santa Cruz, according to the Fitzmaurice Emily Riley sleeping ban / camping ban, which also bars tents, it also bars protective covering, it also bars covering up with blankets. There are actually three different bans enclosed within the one municipal code, 6.36.010, passed by the city back in 1978, and ratified, essentially, by each city council since, because it's refused, in spite of public clamor, to change these laws, in spite of the recommendations of its own Homeless Issues Task Force, in spite of the discoveries of its own task force to examine the camping ordinance, that there's no magnet effect, that in spite of the surveys from United Way's needs assessment, that many of the homeless are resident here and actually born here, native here, or have been here for a considerably long period of time. It's it all falls on deaf ears. It's like water off a an attorney's back. What can you say with these city council people? Headed by Mayor Tim, I'm a Green Party member, but I don't believe I have to follow the Green Party platform. Tim Fitzmaurice, who is a Green Party member, was elected with Green Party endorsement. He still has not been repudiated by the Green Party, although they may be getting closer on that. I've talked about that in the past few shows. The Green Party platform says no sleeping bans. Fitzmaurice presides over a council that not only keeps sleeping bans on the books, but he has refused to allow the sleeping ban on the city council agenda, in spite of attempts, rather feeble attempts, I might add, by council member Ed. I was endorsed by the Greens, and I promised to end the sleeping ban, but I haven't done anything significant around that issue. Porter, he made the attempt to get the issue on the agenda for discussion, I think, in April or in March of this year, and Fitzmaurice said he wouldn't let him. Of course, Porter can insist, but Porter is so polite, he doesn't want to insist. So let people go outside, suffer beatings, suffer accidental deaths, suffer a loss of basic civil rights, suffer refugee status locally. It's okay with Ed. He's got a high school class to teach. I guess that's the story over there. And other city council business to get to. Ed and others have been invited to respond to these concerns. They don't feel they owe us any answers, apparently. And nor do they owe us any solutions, because winter is coming around again. Even though the Armory Winter Shelter opened up November 15th, the report from Manny, who has taken Karen Brock's place as the Homeless Service Center worker down there, who's seeing a lot of folks, and there are a lot of workers actually, she's one of them, said that there will be a picture ID required, probably a state California picture ID, to get into the Winter Armory Shelter, where there will only be 75 spaces in addition to the 39 available for the church floor. So for 1,000, 2,000 homeless people, you want to add up the numbers, that ain't much. And have everybody else facing $54 tickets. It's an old story, it's a bad story, and now's the time to change the story. And Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, is wondering if there is enough will in the community to do that. We've certainly done a lot of work in the past. I think it's time to build on that work, particularly as the Thanksgiving to Christmas season comes up. But realistically, that can't be done without a solid core of people who are willing to work on this issue, I don't know, I used to say 10 hours a week, now I say generously 3 to 5 hours a week in some way, whether it be on the phones, whether it be out at a table, whether it be talking to other groups of people, whether it be sending out letters to the editor, whether it be just organizing in other ways. That has to be done, and because we have a season from November to Christmas, as I said, which is the merchant's top season for doling out their consumer goodies and getting their profits. And that is the opportunity is now to insist that the merchant community acknowledge their responsibility to not criminalize poor people in their midst, or to face the reality that that may redound against them in a business fashion, however much this may seem a rude tactic. I think it's even ruder to have people denied their civil rights each night, and to suffer often life and limb problems because of it. I got a call right before the show. A man who I had previously mentioned, we thought it may have had his throat slit, a man named Randy. His full name actually is Randy Mendoza, I've learned. He actually simply just got his shoulder smashed and was in Dominican for 3 days, and hopefully we're going to have him or someone who was a friend of his on the line during the show to talk about that issue that happened outside while he was sleeping alone, hiding under the sleeping ban, and where there was some concern this may have been an anti-gay attack. We'll learn more about that, an anti-homeless attack. We'll learn more about that. But in any case, these kinds of attacks are prevented by groups like Camp Paradise, assuming that you don't count any internal violence that happens because of a less than ideal democratic or non-democratic patriarchal system they have there. But still, less violence happens in those kinds of communities where people come together and try to work things out themselves. They run their own campground. They support each other. They organize. They clean up the area. They establish relations with their neighbors. They establish a group feeding situation. They do what, you know, people are supposed to do, which is act in a social, self-supporting, mutually self-supporting way. You can't do that when you're driven apart by the laws. In fact, it seems that these laws are even almost designed to make the poor more vulnerable to accidents, death, injury, depression, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, you name it. These laws are, or you might say they're done without any kind of awareness, completely ignoring the fundamental realities that they produce these secondary consequences. And it's all done so that the merchants can clean their streets and the residents don't have to have those awful homeless-looking people in the vicinity. It's a sad situation, and it's one that isn't going to really be, I think, changed simply by trying to act nice and clean up the trash in the area, though I commend that kind of work by those campers that do. You know, the blacks were nice as pie to the white Southerners and didn't mean a damn thing until they got together and demanded their rights. So that's what needs to happen here with groups like Homes on Wheels, the group that formed together after Emily Riley's infamous 5 to 7 a.m. parking signs in Harvey West, or anti-homeless anti-parking signs in the Harvey West, and then her vote to enforce the camping ban along the river, which apparently, according to Deputy Chief Locke in a good story in today's Santa Cruz Sentinel, Sunday Sentinel, is being done, as Mark Premack suggested, on a priority basis. I don't even know if that's actually true, but Camp Paradise has not suffered any tickets, even though Emily Riley gave them the green light. Other campgrounds, of course, have been suffering tickets and have been suffering harassment and have been suffering eviction orders. And that's, I think, in a way, far more significant than Camp Paradise, although Camp Paradise is a shining example and is one I've supported for months and months and continue to support. It is a limited group of people. It's only, I don't know, 40 to 60 people. It fluctuates. And we're talking 1,000 to 2,000 people out there that have got no civil rights at night, thanks to the city's laws. And in terms of if they're sleeping, then they can be searched, they can be arrested, their property can be seized. I would say it's medieval, but in medieval times, people had more rights. I mean, they had a commons in the area. You could use the facilities. The peasants did have certain rights, and now you don't. Instead, it's all about money. It's all about that kind of thing. And that's what I think we have to fight, and we have to get together and change, particularly in times where a war hysteria is drowning out everything else in the newspapers and in the media, with great victorious cries of victory as the Northern Alliance moves into the cities of Afghanistan. Good thing on the one hand, we would hope, because that would mean that refugees can get aid, but the kind of civil war that the Northern Alliance produced last time, and also seems to begin to be producing this time based on preliminary reports from northern cities, is not good. It doesn't mean that the millions of Afghanistan homeless are actually going to get the food they need in a situation that in essence was produced by the United States and the Western allies in conjunction with their former pals, the Taliban, that they supported as part of the Mujahideen against the Soviet Union in one of these CIA Cold War we use you, we dump you deals, which is what happened in the late 70s, early 80s, and early 90s. So Santa Cruz has to look after its own situation. We have to look after each other. Rents are not dropping. There's no move by mayor-to-be Cave-In Crone, as I now call him. I used to call him Candygram Crone because he always had something sweet to tell you. But you'd end up getting real tooth decay if you paid any attention. He doesn't act on the basic issues he needs to act on or truly stand up and advocate for them, ranging from the sleeping ban repeal to rent control to real affordable housing rather than rubber-stamping Mercy Charities housings, pet project, the Dolphin Lee demolition, which went through like shit through a goose on Tuesday at the City Council and will be coming up again this next Tuesday. Lots of the same old things are happening. As I mentioned, the armory is open. I haven't gotten a report on how many people are using it or even able to use it because of this new terrorist alert requiring ID. The massive attacks on civil liberties, of course, continue nationwide, and it's hard to see their effects locally. At least I would like to hear from the folks out there if they've felt local effects of the national crackdown. Obviously, you travel by air, and you're a Green Party member, watch out. They stopped stopped at least one, maybe two Green Party members from even traveling by air. You have to suddenly submit to, the police become all powerful at these airports. It's not like, I mean, it's not as though there was a higher level of danger. There isn't. I mean, there was. There were two major terrorist incidents, and then there was the anthrax deal. But in terms of the general level of danger, you know, it's not like you have to wear a gun as you walk down the streets. But that's the inference that's being used, the implication that's being used by the government and the media to sell papers, the government to sell more power and its program, which is to pump billions into the military while the rest of the country goes begging, and of course while the same policies that created the terrorism continue to run rampant throughout the world because of the numerous things. But one contributing factor that's very significant, of course, is the United States government and its involvement in militarily in the Middle East, and its concern about oil in the Afghanistan area and the Middle East. It's not something I want to go into in great length. I'm sure most of you who've been listening are really sick of this stuff, or at least you have lots of sources for it. But I do want to talk about local stuff, and I want to have you folks talk about local stuff. I'm actually going to try to call up and get in touch with Patches, who... She was a squeegee woman downtown at New Leaf, parking lot for a couple years there with her partner, and I think she's since moved indoors. She was concerned about this attack on a homeless gay man, Randy. We're going to talk about that, too, later. We're going to talk about the National Guard Armory situation up in Santa Rosa and the use of the National Guard Armory opening to crack down on homeless people along the river up there. We're going to talk about what's happening in Santa Barbara, where the authorities that be, the powers that be, seem to be closer to supporting some kind of arrangement for people in vehicles to live in, unlike Santa Cruz, which still refuses to do what Eugene did, set up small legal areas for people, or to do what Michael Schmidt and the Homeless Working Group proposed a year ago, open up the county parking lot at night, or the Emmeline Street parking lot when it isn't used, when there are restrooms present. That's still being ignored by Kevin Crone and Marty Wormhout. Let's call her Whiplash Wormhout. We're going to hear more stuff about that. In the meantime, let's hear a little bit about sort of some updates. Here's an interview with Richard, who has been a Camp Paradise resident for a long time. He isn't anymore. He's found housing, and we're going to have him talk about his was the ticket that came out of the downtown 113-hour support tabling activity for Camp Paradise, where you may have seen it down there in front of Borders on Pacific Avenue, where there was a vehicle with a tent on the back of it. Folks were very concerned Camp Paradise was going to be swept away this summer, as indeed I think it probably would have been had it not been for the high public response. And that actually comes out to some extent, as I mentioned, in Dan White's article in today's Santa Cruz Sunday Sentinel, which is a pretty good article. It misses a couple of things. It misses the incredible bigotry that's now running the state parks locally, where you can only use a total of 30 days in all Santa Cruz. I think it's all Santa Cruz parks, and maybe in all state parks nationwide. I mean, statewide, but it's you can't spend more than 14 days in one park, and you can't spend more than 30 days in the Santa Cruz area. They want to get rid of homeless people. It's really the same old story. The same nasty, bigoted, a couple of steps back from genocide, but it's this mentality that some people are less deserving of basic human rights than others, and it leads to that kind of thing. Why not just simply have an H, a yellow H on everybody's... you don't need a yellow H for homeless people, because people who are homeless often appear homeless, although some people you wouldn't even know are homeless because they try to pass as Jews and blacks, and others had to pass in the past as part of the white middle-class majority, or else they would be discriminated against. Let's hear a little bit from Richard here. It's an interview that happened about a week ago.
It's about 15 to 2. We're in the Kinko's parking lot downtown in the afternoon of November 14th, Wednesday. The sun's out, a lot of puffy white clouds on the horizon. We're talking to a former Camp Paradise activist. Looks like a man was still, he's got a bicycle to his name. And local, well, how would you describe yourself, Richard?
Just a local, around all over the place in the community.
You actually have a place to live now. Before you were in, should we say, somewhat in campy quarters at Camp Paradise.
Yeah, I got myself a little trailer. I'm staying in on some property now. But for...
How long were you on the Camp Paradise?
I was in Camp Paradise by 3.5 months. Uh-huh. I thought it was really good cause for me to experience the situation with the homeless people and some of the traumatic things that happened could let a homeless person down. One really nice thing that I got out of Camp Paradise is I got that motel voucher for them 2 days, and them 2 days really made me feel human, where I could just sit there and watch a little TV or take a shower or wash my face or wash my hands and lay back down.
This was quite a process, and you weren't able to use the motel voucher on August 3rd, the morning they came and ticketed people, right?
Right. That was far beyond after the day that we got ticketed.
Sometime later, through Karen Brock's intervention, you were able to get I guess these were issued by the police department on the day that some 30-odd tickets were issued by the police and, you know, on the camp, around Camp Paradise and up and down the river. But none of the vouchers that I've yet heard of were actually usable on that day, and very few were given out to Camp Paradise residents.
Yeah, there's just very few of us who got the voucher.
And you were able to eventually use yours, what, a week or two later?
Actually, it was about almost a month later.
I know that you had some problems initially with the Seabreeze Motel that treated you rather badly, right?
Yeah, they were just absolutely unprofessional, especially at the clerks and the owner, the way that the owner handled that situation with me. Yeah, I was real disappointed.
As a homeless person, they ordered you to leave, and even though you've been sent there by a county agency that they were taking money from, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it just
city.
Yeah, it really hurt me in a lot of different ways, but mainly emotional. And being homeless, it was just even more let down on the situation in life.
Now, what about that organization that let you down, HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, that was going to write a letter on your behalf to criticize that motel? Did they ever do that?
I don't know.
I don't think they did. I think we'd have to look into HUF there.
Yeah, that would work.
Around to get your number again. Possibly we can get in touch with you as a guilty HUF member. I'm interested in following through on that sometime. Mm-hmm. You also, however, were back in court because when you were tabling for Camp Paradise downtown after the panic of early July when officers were threatening to remove the camp, and the 113 hours of tabling straight happened downtown. At the Camp Paradise table, you were parked next to a vehicle on top of which was mounted a tent, and I know you got some hassles from parking maids and men, even though you have a disabled placard and you are disabled.
Yes, I am 100% on my back.
Yeah, and you were also faced a confrontation with an officer, Richards, who apparently got into it with you and claimed you were blocking the sidewalk. But what actually happened in that situation?
Well, there was about 20 of us sitting around, and we were all discussing about the project that we had going on about Camp Paradise and supporting Camp Paradise and how things are right and how some things aren't really fair treated. So while we were sitting there standing on the sidewalk with these 20 people, the officer came through and chosen me to give me the tickets, saying that I was obstructing traffic on the parkway.
Remember, he bumped you initially?
Yes, he did bump me as he walked right up to me, and I asked him first to apologize to me, and there was no apology at all, and he pushed through me and told me that I was going to lose the battle about Camp Paradise and lose the battle with him and I.
But in fact, the Camp Paradise lawyer, Leonard the lawyer, went into court with you
Leonard the lawyer.
a few weeks ago, and I guess the ticket was, he made a demur, which means he claimed that the form in which the ticket was written or the law under which it was written was wrong on its face. So before you even got into considering the facts in the trial, the demur issue had to be faced, and the DA just called it quits.
Yeah, said there was lack of interest in this case.
And you were of course the crime you were accused of was obstructing the sidewalk, which meant that you were refusing to move. That's what obstructing the sidewalk means. Sergeant Baker's recent tickets in the last few days, or recent ticket, I'm told he gave a ticket to a young person. This recent ticket notwithstanding, he gave a ticket to a young person for being in the sidewalk without even telling him that he was obstructing it, and that's completely illegal because you have to at least ask someone to move, and then they refuse to move, then you're, as I understand it, obstructing the sidewalk.
Yep, yes, sir.
Keep that in mind.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
All right. 2-0. We're here at the Farmer's Market.
No, actually, we're here at Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3. This is Bathrobes Pier's Broadsides, Civil Rights Here in the City. And we have a phone number if you want to call in, 427-3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3. And if you want to catch us off-air, that is to say, if you want to catch Free Radio off-air, which takes public service announcements, you can give a call to 427-4523. We're also looking for donations. You can send those to Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Again, Free Radio Santa Cruz, Post Office Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Donations mean that we keep our equipment current. It means that we are able to upgrade the equipment. And, of course, there's my special Tahiti Retirement Fund, which does need a little nest egg. Actually, all kidding aside, none of this money actually goes to me. In fact, all of the broadcasters contribute to the costs of the station. We actually pay our own way here. If you're interested in actually getting a program on Free Radio Santa Cruz, you can also leave a message at 427-4523. We're interested in broadcasters. You will be asked to prepare a demo tape of the kind of show you want to do and send it in, and then you'll talk to one of our inimitable little subcommittees, and they'll kind of run through the deal with you and see if they like what you've got and see if it fits in terms of if you are ideologically correct and if you are doing something that isn't being done by 15 other people. And I try to be very candid about this. I'm as critical often of my fellow Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcasters as I am of people outside the area. I like the station the way it's going. I sometimes have disagreements, but it is true. Free Radio Santa Cruz is not free speech for everybody, everywhere, at all times in terms of, for example, hate speech. If you want to talk about the inferiority of the races and the need to drive the Jews and the blacks from the community or kill the homeless, best you start your own radio station, and that's actually not so hard to do. You can start your own radio station. I really wish others would, because it's relatively cheap. It would be a real example of a grassroots democracy. Students could afford to do that if they got together to do it. Come on, you students. KZSC is a pale shadow of the kind of station that Free Radio Santa Cruz is and other stations could be, and it doesn't cost more than $500 to $1,000. I mean, you can get that kind of money if you get 20 or 30 people together in a collective just by passing the hat, almost. It's amazing. It's real democracy. It's real free speech. You don't wait for the Sentinel to print your letter. You don't hope to be able to get on Ron Owens KGO or coax your way past Michael Zwirling of KSCO here. You have your own station. You say what you want. You want to say fuck, you say fuck. You want to call a spade, you do so. You want to speak out about the genocide that's going on in terms of the indiscriminate killing. Genocide's actually focused killing, so let's just say the collateral damage stuff that's going on in Afghanistan and elsewhere, thanks to the U.S. government. You can talk about it. You don't have to wait for permission. You want to talk about the bullshit going on at city council, masquerading as progressive politics. You can also talk about that. But you need to have a medium to do it, and I would encourage people, start your own station, or if you feel like you have stuff you can contribute to this station, you can call in and talk about anything you want on my show. I'm not going to censor you no matter what you say, unless you get too boring or the thing seems completely off topic. So give a call to 427-3772, although I encourage people to try to stay on what we're talking about, which is civil rights. Have the police harassed you or abused you? What do you think of the need for some meaningful political pressure on the city council at its next to the last meeting of the year, which will be on November 27th, City Council meets again to crown a new mayor. King Crone, we assume, is going to be the new mayor. And then you're going to have another session in December, and then everybody disappears, and the homeless get to feel the full brunt of the sleeping ban over the Christmas as an example of, I guess, a Christmas gift. Our business as usual, actually. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, just real quick, I just wanted to bring up something that happened to me last night.
Okay.
Went out to Moon Rocks to check out the awesome meteor shower.
I heard about that.
And I don't know what the situation is with the property out there and who's allowed to go there and not. I knew we couldn't park right next to the road, so we went down there where parking is not prohibited. And sure enough, Johnny Law comes by there and is like, well, you know, all those bad people up there with their bad, awful telescopes, and we're going to give them all $500 fines and send them to prison.
And now, where was this again?
Moon Rocks up there off Empire Grade, off Ice Cream Road.
So is this with these sheriffs or were these SCPD? Were they in green uniforms or in blue uniforms?
Can't remember. I know it was Officer Coyne from Felton area.
Probably was a sheriff. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
You're right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the deal? What's the big problem up there? It's a beautiful place to go and hang out and be above the fog.
Well, we are a frustrated society, and individuals in uniforms with badges and guns who can't exercise control and power, this is my sort of amateur psychiatrist analysis, do so. And in other words, power corrupts. It doesn't just corrupt in terms of people, you know, becoming financially more, shall we say, graspy, greedy, and loose about with other people's money. It also has to do with people becoming looser with other people's rights. There's a certain thrill in exercising control over other people. You and I both know that too, I'm sure. You know, it's a temptation for all of us.
Yeah, of course. I got the same feeling from him as I did listening from Terry Gross's interview to the chief of police of New York. The same kind of thing of, I don't know, cracking down on people doing something that, or anything, having some fun, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a matter of if you have an excuse. You know, there's a terrorist menace. There's a danger to the environment. There's a whatever you will. It becomes, and you have the power to do it. You have a gun, a radio, a baton, a bulletproof vest on. You're getting paid $38 an hour or $35 an hour, whatever they're getting these days. Then the temptation comes to use that power. And now, there are those who say to me, well, you know, they're good cops and they're bad cops, and, you know, a lot of police just want to leave homeless people alone. And that's certainly true to some extent, but it's not a function of the individual here. It's a function of an institution. It's a function of a whole system of thinking and training and expectations. And, you know, it's also set up so that I think it sets it up so the worst can abuse this system without any kind of meaningful checks, because it's not transparent and there's no way to get... There's no community control of police, for example, either in the city, where they have the Citizens Police Rah-Rah Board, as I call it, which is a token group, or in the county where there's no board, and there's simply the police investigate themselves. The deputy sheriffs have their own IA department, Internal Affairs, which essentially does nothing, as far as I've seen. So I appreciate your calling in.
Great. I appreciate your comments, and I'm going to say goodbye and turn the radio back up.
Sure, and hey, keep watching. Don't let them scare you off.
Right on.
Thank you.
See you, man.
Bye-bye.
And I appreciate the call. It really is important to hear from you folks out there. I think it's important for, frankly, a number of reasons. I think it's good therapy, frankly, to call in. I think it's good to get to share your fears, and, you know, it's kind of humiliating to be stopped by the police. It makes you feel that maybe you are in the wrong. And also it's kind of intimidating, so it makes you feel like maybe you want to keep a little quieter, keep your head a little lower, say a little less, that sort of thing. And it's good to say, to resist those impulses and fight them and realize that you're not alone. This is something that's being done methodically and habitually and abusively to person after person after person after person in this community. You know, it's true that there are problems that develop. I'm not saying that a police force isn't necessarily required in some cases. I haven't gone to that point. Although I'd like what some call utopian alternatives, looking for conflict reconciliation and real sort of community watch rather than police watch. But I think that the police are paid to enforce a system of laws that discriminate against poor people, and they are, you know, obviously enforcing a whole economic system that makes everybody work for the benefit of a few. I mean, there's just no question about it to me. So it's important that those of us who are, all of us, subject to these conditions, these laws, these police practices, stand up as much as we can together, and that's really hard unless we raise our voices on shows like this. And in public, when you see police misconduct happening, I again repeat, stop, observe. Police officer says, step back, this is none of your business. You take one step back, and you stay there. You have to leave, sir. You take another step back, and you stay there. You remain calm. You hold on to yourself, even though you're afraid, even though you're confronting an individual with a gun and a badge and a whole institution of law and force and violence behind her or him, mostly him. And you recognize that unless you take a stand there, then you'll be afraid every step of the way, every place you go. That you could be controlled there. If they can do it to somebody else, then they can do it to you. That's the story here, and that's the story. It's going to be an increasingly difficult story as we go through this bad period coming up. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and that's the good story. I'm glad to see we're maintaining ourselves here. I'm going to play a little something from Carol Denny's Failure to Disperse. Stick with us. I'll be back. And I hope you'll be back. 427-3772. Lines are open. One of many good political songs. We're playing some more of her stuff, and we often do. 96.3 FM is what you're tuned to. 427-3772 is the number to call so we can get tuned to you. Give us a call. I'm going to play again an interview I did at the very end of the last show, or played it, actually. We do a show twice a week, Thursdays and Sundays. Today we go to 1:30. Thursdays at 6 to 8 in the evening. We invite you to join us here at 96.3, or I do anyway, the Royal Old Me. This is an interview with David, who has some rather controversial things to say about WHAM, the local semi-legal medical marijuana group, which I'm always glad to see medical marijuana groups springing up. I don't like it when they don't support other groups and they kind of become exclusionary and seem to not be working in the best interests of the majority of folks seeking medical marijuana. but they do serve a few. It's always the problem where you serve a few, but you don't serve the many. The same thing happens to some extent with Camp Paradise, where Camp Paradise is left alone, largely by the city, but other people are suffering, and that needs to be addressed. That's hopefully what we're going to address at the next HUF meeting. Come to the next HUF meeting, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, Wednesday at Baker's Square at 8:30. More about that later. But let's hear a little bit about medical marijuana again.
310, we're talking to
David Harding.
And David, you're an old-time fighter for medical marijuana.
Yeah.
In fact, you pointed out to me that 5 years ago today, council member, perhaps then mayor, Mike Rodkin, declared today National Medical Marijuana Day.
Here in the city of Santa Cruz.
City Marijuana Day.
City Santa Cruz Medical Marijuana Day.
Right, of course, this is the same city council that has refused to allow Kate Wells's cannabis pharmaceuticals to survive. It went down last year because Mayor Sugar would not declare a medical marijuana emergency. You yourself have had a kind of a falling out with the one, I don't want, quasi-legal or at least acknowledged organization in town, WAM. WAM stands for?
Women and Men's Alliance for Medical Marijuana.
And you yourself were a part of that, but you were accused of what, stealing money or?
Being a major pot dealer and stealing from their medical marijuana garden.
And this is because you provided grow systems to people who are outside the WAM system?
Yeah, in accordance with city law, which I helped did write some of, I had obtained a business license and a state franchise tax board ID number, and could not charge for the product itself, but by the hour of the time I put into it. And that started taking off, and had a parting out with WAM, being that I was doing something that was not conducive to being a member of WAM. And so some stories
helping
were
people who for medical marijuana?
Yeah. A lot of patients that are quadriplegics, most of them with acquired injuries, cannot make it to a WAM meeting, or they don't want to be seen going into a distribution center for their own personal private reasons.
Mm-hmm. I see you have a man in a wheelchair with you today. Is that person you're helping?
Yeah. Supplying with so illegal marijuana?
I am educating him how to provide for himself a natural source of medicine within the guidance of California law, which the voters had passed.
Well, what's to be done to, we understand that there are now threats of attacks on WAM now that El Dorado and LA clubs have been closed. I'm naturally sympathetic to any medical marijuana club, but I'm concerned that WAM has done nothing to support the needs of a majority of the medical marijuana people in this town who need access to medical marijuana. What do you think of that charge?
It's a pretty exclusive club to get in. After me suing the Sheriff's Department, it still took me a year before I was accepted. And of course, I only have a head trauma, which leaves me with seizures. It's pretty much exclusive, which is known by members and non-members alike. You're not a rubber stamper for the board. You know, you get inferior medicines from WAM, lower grade. And a lot of people have walked away from WAM, being members of WAM. And others, of course, have joined it. But the novelty wears off when any of your ideas are put on the back burner to further patients getting their natural source of medicine.
Well, I know that, as I said, I didn't see WAM coming forward to support the 600 to 800, I guess to 1,000 patients that Cannabis Pharmaceuticals was supplying until it was forced out of business by zoning objections and being moved from one place to another a year ago, and the council needed to declare a medical marijuana emergency but refused to return any calls to Kate Wells. I think that Valerie Corral, who heads WAM, could have had a significant impact on that, but chose not to. Instead, parades around Mother Jones and the pages of the Slick magazines showing off her physique. I don't regard that as particularly helpful, unless you are, you know, acting on behalf of the entire community of people. I don't know, am I being too harsh on this woman?
Not really. Personally, I don't believe so. When I was a member of WAM when Detective John... Jim Hart and Dan Campos visited my house and seized my garden.
What year was that?
That was in 97. April 97, just after 4 months after G15 had passed. I took civil action against him and, of course, received it back under guidance of Tracy, Sheriff Mark Tracy, and Kim Allen.
You won some money?
At the time, I was a little nervous about taking monetary damages. I figured I kicked him in the balls once by forcing him to give me back my pot.
Kick him again, man.
Yeah, I should have.
That way they make sure that they don't come back,
But anyway,
third time.
After they raided me and seized my 18 plants, my argument was that they violated California law by illegally seizing my prescribed medication. They are not licensed physicians in California to effectively and immediately cut a patient off of medicine. I asked WAM members and WAM for support to show up at the courthouse with me, and of course no one did. But it was only after that I received my property back and my cannabis that I was rendered a hero, but no one stepped forth.
You got no support. What about those phonies over at Huff, Homeless United? Yeah, should you get any support from them?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Just like
that
I
fine Robert Norris that you're talking to? Yeah. Did he support you?
Yeah, fine Robert Norris.
Yeah, so there.
Yeah. Becky Johnson.
Well, anything else you want to say regarding the medical marijuana scene or anything else?
Well, the voters passed on it, and there's been seven other states, and that adds up to probably 8-9 million people that have voted for this. And so with the new administration and George W. Bush's administration, with the new Attorney General and the FBI Director and new DEA, they might come down, but what we got to do is, if you're not growing at home, you got a recommendation, start. Back it up. Back up your vote by taking action.
Are there any new clubs forming that you recommend people get involved with?
Not to my knowledge, not in the immediate area. Not that
also
I know.
Smoke in at city council might be appropriate?
That would be nice to see. I'm all for it. I'll show up.
Board of supervisors?
Board of supervisors. I'm bored of the supervisors.
That's for sure, man. Smarty Wormhout, I don't know what to say. Anyway, thank you.
Oh, thank you, Robert.
So, David, you also mentioned that you were stopped without pot or money on Front and Soquel by one of the Santa Cruz finest for
loitering for engaging in drug activity.
Maybe talking about drugs?
Talking about electrical systems.
Oh, well, talking about electrical drugs.
They straight into grow.
So were you actually taken to trial, or was any charge ever levied?
They haven't filed charges yet, so I got to spend an hour to 2 hours a week out of my time to go to the courthouse waiting for a decision from the district attorney.
Running your butt around, eh?
Yeah, I think that's the whole motive behind it.
Well, there is rumor that I spoke with actually Matisse of the Sushi Now stand outside of New Leaf Market, and he may have heard a rumor that there's a plan afoot to remove the entire Cathcart hippie planter area in order to spruce things up for the downtown.
Well, I believe the city council would go for that. This is Santa Cruz. You're not going to stop the ambience of Santa Cruz by relocating a planter.
Oh, I think they just destroy the planter and turn it into a Cinema 9 type scene where you can't easily sit down unless you're paying for
commercial venue. Right. City needs more tax money. Actually, man, the taxes here are pretty high.
Very taxing.
Smell good green.
Indeed. Well, thank you there, David.
Thank you, Robert.
So, with us here at Sushi Now, in front of New Leaf Market, about 4:05, is Scott Simmons. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Bob.
Whatever. So, Scott, you're a man who actually got some dispensations here when you were living in your vehicle up around in Kinko's. You have two disabled children, one disabled child and one baby, and you had a medical marijuana prescription for one or both of them, I guess one of them, and for yourself, and you had a you were left alone by police for a considerable number of weeks or even months, and then suddenly the crackdown came.
Yeah, sort of, although, the crackdown on me was my fault. My registration was expired.
So, but eventually you left town.
Yeah, that was over services for my disabled daughter. But I went back up to Quincy, up in the National Forest, and they're practicing a particularly vicious form of discrimination against the homeless there, much like Portland. You're no longer allowed to camp in the National Forest unless you've got a home somewhere. You used to be allowed 30 days in the National Forest, 2 weeks in one spot. I'm talking about the Plumas National Forest up there by Quincy. And now you're not allowed any time at all unless you have a home elsewhere. If you don't have a home elsewhere, you are living on the National Forest, subject to arrest and a potential $5,000 fine. I know about all of this because the federal law enforcement came by, still in the state of California, still in pot-friendly Plumas County, where the sheriff is a personal friend of mine, and federal law enforcement came by and busted me for smoking some of my medicine before dinner. I had 2 grams of Mexican marijuana. They took that, took the stash box, didn't take me to jail. Because
when was this?
This was June. But they did haul me into federal court, make a federal case out of it, threaten me with a year in jail and a $100,000 fine for 2 grams of pot. Did hire me an attorney, and eventually said, look, you donate $200 to the charity of your choice, we'll drop the charges. Which I thought was pretty cool, because they said, we don't recognize your prescription. At the same time, obviously, they were recognizing it. But this federal law enforcement guy they got up there, and I guess a lot of the Rainbow Gathering people know him because he's worked the last 3 gatherings. His name is Nelson. He's a real dick. Can I say that?
Dick Nelson, perhaps.
No,
not Ricky Nelson.
No, his name ain't Dick Nelson, but he is one. Anyway, he's been known to drive 200 miles to verify whether people actually have a home elsewhere. And
a conscientious law enforcement officer.
Yes. Yeah. And I was, I was hauled into court twice, so I got to see any number of poor people there being prosecuted under the living on the National Forest. And the way it works is that they gave me a lawyer because they were threatening me with a year in jail. But the law says that if the government waives incarceration, they don't need to provide an attorney. So these homeless people were unrepresented, and were receiving, you know, smaller fines. The cases I saw, some of the cases were being pursued, though, to a great degree of prosecution, and I don't know what they were doing to these poor people. But it was frightening to me, and I gave my attorney your name because I remembered the court case in Portland on a similar law, that it was all right to camp on the streets in Portland. And I didn't know if that was a state judge or a federal judge that threw that out.
State, actually, it was Judge Gallagher, and it was a state law.
Yeah. And so we're back in Santa Cruz. Actually, we found a place to live. I'm paying $500 a month for a trailer space up in the mountains, and pretty happy to have it. You know, I miss my friends on the street, but I'm happy to be off the street. I really am.
We'll ask you more, but there's a heavy drumming activity going on not 200 feet from where we're sitting. So, hey, we'll thank you very much, Scott.
Okay. Thank you, Robert. Good to see
you again. So you noticed last night when you were out here on at Hippie Planter increased police presence?
Yeah, it was a few nights ago. I don't remember exactly when, but I noticed an increased police presence, you know, increased hassling of people on the street and on the sidewalk. And it just looked like they were cracking down again. And in our travels, we've seen this kind of thing in Berkeley and San Francisco and Santa Cruz, where they'll come in, run all the kids out. Essentially, they go to another town and, then come back later. Now, what was funny, in the Haight-Ashbury, they busted, every pot dealer on the street, and the tourists aren't coming around anymore, because big surprise, the tourists weren't coming up there to visit the local shops. They're coming up there to score weed. And then they'd, you know, visit the shops as an afterthought. So it was kind of self-defeating in the hate. But
this was recently, or this was a long time ago?
This was about 2 years ago. But they do these sweeps periodically and just, you know, move the kids around from town to town. I've seen them do the same thing in Berkeley. They'll just, or in Santa Cruz, they'll move a huge police presence onto the street, harass everybody, bust as many kids as they can. And, the kids are smart. They'll go somewhere else for a while. But, you know, I do see that Santa Cruz looks a lot more repressive. I notice a lot of the motorhomes are gone. I don't know exactly what's going on.
Out by Kinko's or by Costco's?
By Costco.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They formed an organization called Homes on Wheels. Becky probably talked to you about that.
Uh-huh. Well, I heard about it, yeah.
I can actually give you the phone numbers of the people who are involved if you're interested.
Yeah, I would be, because even though we have a place to live right now, who knows how long that'll last. And My feeling was when they made the parking restriction from 5 to 7 in the morning that everybody should move down to Pacific Avenue at 5 o'clock in the morning.
That's an excellent idea.
And if everybody wants to do that, I'll come down here with a bag of quarters and I'll feed the parking meters for y'all. How about that? Because not everybody has a disabled placard.
But come to the next Huff meeting, 8:30 Wednesday at Baker Square.
Is that tonight or?
No, that's next Wednesday.
Yeah, in the morning. Okay, I'll try if you write that down for me. So I can remember.
It actually, maybe in the street shit sheet. So we're talking here with our Eyes on the Borders bookstore man,
Sid DeVicious.
Vicious Sid. And SV, what have you found at Borders?
Oh, I heard that their bathrooms were closed as a result of higher level management decisions because there were too many people going in there who they didn't find respectable.
Or possibly not even paying customers.
That's quite possible.
Now, of course, they've closed the bathrooms to everybody, including paying customers.
Yes, that's my understanding of the situation.
I know that for a time they required you to go get a token at the information counter. Now, apparently, that is gone as well.
Kaput kablooey.
And there you have it. We're here at the Food Not Bombs mini-serving, a small gathering of non-drummer individuals, and Brian D. Koepke. Hey, Brian.
Hi. We collected all kinds of food today, and the Hungry Horde came and ate it. And it's been a real quiet day, and we're really glad it isn't raining, even though we did serve Saturday at the clock, despite the rain, and people made it and ate the soup and had a good time.
Tomorrow, you say, is court day for Michael Fine, a.k.a. Victim, the man who was fighting the clear-cutting up in the... where the hell was that, anyway?
In the county here somewhere, locally. And actually Friday morning, I believe it's Friday morning or afternoon, it's in Judge Barton's Superior Court in Santa Cruz, B-A-R-T-O-N. Barton is not necessarily a bad guy, Michael Barton. He does have a liberal reputation.
I call him Barracuda Barton myself.
Well, I knew him years ago when he just started out. That's when I was able to see what he was doing then. And he's facing felony vandalism, and that's on that day Friday. It is another trial date, but there'll probably be a delay because the case keeps being delayed. Some of these cases get delayed a year, especially when they're political.
Well, in this current climate, delay might be a virtue rather than a drawback. You also mentioned that there's a local in jail you're concerned about.
Well, the police do pick on some of the people on the streets, and they'll just come and take them away. And one of our sisters, lots of our sisters, our brothers, are in jail. And the jails are overcrowded. They have triple bunk beds, and then that's not enough. They put people on the floor, too, yet. And the jail is way past its rated capacity, and it has been for years.
There you have it. Thank you. Anything new on the camping ticket scene?
Well, I'm going to go out in the woods and find out if the rangers stole my stuff or not. I'm going to go out and find out if my camp's still there or if some people who were hired went out and collected it all in wheelbarrows again. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. Did that happen before recently?
Oh, it's happened. It's happened that rangers out in the Poganip and the police go out and hire crews of temporary workers, and they have a supervisor, and they go around with wheelbarrows and collect people's belongings.
Well, scavenger hunt.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Brian Koepke at the Farmer's Market giving us an update on how folks who are outside apparently basic constitutional protections. On the line, we have a man who is interested in constitutional protections, Paul Sanford, attorney for Camp Paradise. Hey, Paul.
Good afternoon, Robert.
Well, we're intruding into your home at a high noon on Sunday, but I guess tomorrow at 1:30 there's going to be another kind of high noon downtown, huh?
Well, the trial for the so-called Paradise 8 begins at 1:30, and this is the trial of 8 clients of mine who've been ticketed for so-called illegal setting up of a camp last August 2nd and 3rd, and we're going to court trial to force the prosecution, the city attorney, to prove that they are guilty of this offense, and we believe they are not guilty.
Mm-hmm. And actually, it's interesting, they've left the campers pretty much alone as far as new camping tickets go, yet they're continuing to
go after these. Why is that? Any ideas?
I don't know. It's very difficult for me to get into the head and the mindset of the city attorney's office. Clearly, since the police issued the tickets and the district attorney declined to prosecute, then the city officials had only two alternatives: to have the city attorney try the case, and I can't remember any time in recent history where the city attorney has tried a case in Superior Court, or to let it go. And they've determined, whether it's for legal reasons, public policy reasons, political reasons, or other, that they choose to prosecute, and that's their discretion.
Huh. So it's 130 in Department 1 down at 701 Ocean Street at the courthouse, right?
That's right. We don't know whether the trial will be concluded in that afternoon or whether it will carry further. That's an open question. But to the extent people out there are supportive of the camp or supportive of justice in general, then we would encourage folks to come down to the Superior Court. It's the very first courtroom after the metal detector at 1:30, and sit in and show your support. If you can't stay all afternoon, just come for the first 5 or 10 minutes to send a message to the judge and to the city that the camp has popular support.
And if worse comes to worse, we can set up a tent outside the court and camp down there.
Well, here's a first for me, Robert. No comment.
Thank you. All right. Well, I'm glad to see you're not encouraging illegal behavior. And I hope that
not
we'll
in
see
my public life.
Indeed. I hope we'll see some legal behavior. Well, we will see some legalistic behavior certainly tomorrow as you cross swords with, I guess, either Jennifer Pouchot, the deputy city attorney, or else the grand old man himself, John Barisone. Who knows?
Apparently,
huh?
Your prediction that the city would dismiss has not happened, but that still could happen tomorrow. We'll see about that.
Yeah, I hope that I'm wrong, because I think this is a golden media opportunity. And
well,
I think
if nothing else, I pledge to put on a very vigorous defense, and we hope and expect that justice will prevail.
And you'll be using the necessity defense, which we'll talk about off air. I know you're busy and eager.
If necessary, we're going to the so-called necessity defense does not come into play until after the prosecuting authority has proved their case beyond a reasonable doubt, and I'm going to be interested to see how they do that.
Huh. All right. Well, I will be talking to you later today to grill you further, and we'll pass on the results to the radio audience on
Terrific.
Thursday.
And have a nice day.
Thanks.
And that was accessible attorney Paul Sanford, one of the few who actually can be found, gives out his home phone number, and takes on pro bono cases of poor people, at least in this particular case, the Camp Paradise case. A busy guy with two young children. My hat's off to him. He particularly also is not a great expert on camping defenses or on criminal law in terms of court stuff. He hasn't been much into criminal law in court, but he's taken on that burden because he saw it was a case of real need and real injustice. And hey, more power to you, Paul Sanford. Come on down tomorrow to the county courthouse. That's at Ocean and Water Street, 701 Ocean, technically. It's the flat building next to the five-story county building on San Lorenzo River. And it's, as Paul said, the first courtroom right past the metal detector. Department 1 Judge Joseph, is commissioner, actually, is the fellow who will be hearing these cases. Leave all anthrax and nuclear weapons outside. And we'll proceed to see if we actually get some justice out of this. The issue is going to be, is there a reasonable doubt that there was that these people intended to set up a campsite? And then even if they are convicted of that, is there a reality that they had a necessity to set up a campsite, even though they were violating the law, that they were avoiding or averting a greater evil? So come on down and check that out. Let me know what you think about all this, too, if you want to talk about it. We're Talk Radio, 427-3772, Free Speech Radio. Your speech, it's free. You don't have to pay for it, and it's free. We don't suppress it. So you get the benefit of both freedoms, and it doesn't cost a penny. Of course, it does cost you 50 cents if you don't have a telephone. And I've been trying to reach Larry Templeton down at Camp Paradise. Haven't been able to do it. Kind of an update on what's been happening at Camp Paradise. I haven't been down there in the last couple of days. Did get down there with the Homes on Wheels representative, David Allen. That's the group over at Harvey West that is fighting back against Emily Good Things to Eat bakery owner Riley, also a councilwoman who's supporting anti-homeless laws, votes that hurt the poor, as the banner in front of her store accurately said when it was being held up there a couple weeks ago. Camp Paradise is facing the winter, possibility of flooding if the river gets high as it does every 3 to 20 years, and pick your figure as to how frequently that happens. It's supposed to be a dry year this year, so it doesn't look like there's an immediate crisis, and police have stayed away, but there have been threats from the not terribly reliable officer Eric Seeley, that they're going to be busting Camp Paradise next week. He said that to several people, but he's not been known to be terribly accurate in his predictions or even truthful in his assertions in some cases in the past. I actually ran into a tape from 1997 where officers Seeley and Lefevre, who has since left the force after mishandling a crowd control situation in 1999 in a Steve Argue famous case that actually has been showing up on famous police videos where Steve punched Lefevre. But anyway, Lefevre and Seeley were walking the streets, and a man complained that Seeley and Lefevre took $300 from him in the supposed marijuana arrest, but then didn't cite him or ticket him, just took the money from him and also didn't give him a receipt. And Officer Seeley, when asked about that, denied it publicly on tape, even though other witnesses had seen it. And it was a false statement on his part. And it's just, maybe he looked away when Lefevre did it. I suppose then it wouldn't be a false statement. It would just be an example of turning your eyes away from behavior that was bad behavior. Lefevre and Seeley both claimed that you don't have to give an individual receipt when you seize evidence. When you seize money as evidence, I think you do. And I think at least, that you owe that out of the respect of a person that whose goods you're taking, even if you consider them guilty of a crime like selling marijuana, one of those major sins that so funds our police department and our law enforcement system. And it's such a major concern downtown that it's resulted in surveillance cameras, a drug war that has brought endless grief. I don't need to go on about this. Anyway, so Camp Paradise is still with us, even though the armory opened on the 15th, even though they theoretically can say to the Camp Paradise people, you can all go to the armory. You have to present, I'm told, picture ID, as I mentioned earlier, to get into the armory, so maybe some can't go to the armory. And Camp Paradise is in some anxiety as to what's going to happen next. Now, there's a group called Friends of Camp Paradise, working at one point with the Community Housing Land Trust, then later with Paul Lee's group, the Santa Cruz Service Corps, or the United Services Corporation, or United Services Agency, USA, which is working on this idea of having a Camp Paradise and similar groups of folks camp temporarily in parks or on green belts and in the Pogonip, although that was scotched by environmentalists in the city council, or seems to have been so far, and clean up areas, be available to run around and do the kind of work that the city can't afford to pay its workers for in terms of cleaning up green belt areas, making them environmentally replanting native plants and things of that, and that restocking native fauna and that sort of thing. All the things that I'm not terribly excited about. I'm more concerned about shelter for poor people, but I guess, it's nice to have green areas where all of us can use, and that are certainly more nice for folks with, as Becky Johnson put it, joggers and polo ponies to go out on, and they can check those things out. And hikers, and folks who like an environment that is not concreted over, no question about that. Anyway, Lee and his organization, Tom Shaver acting as a spokesperson. Tom is paid by representative, Councilmember Kennedy, and I think he's also been hired by Paul Lee to kind of put together this scheme, and he's put together a lot of work on his own. I don't want to put down Tom Shaver. I think he's done some good work on this situation. He has been speaking at city council meeting after city council meeting, kind of giving them updates, and a lot of us have been anxious that the police are about to crack down on Camp Paradise because of resolutions like Emily Riley's back in October that said enforce all laws along the river. Police aren't enforcing the camping ban at Camp Paradise. That's a fact, and that's a good fact. Unfortunately, the bad fact is they're enforcing it elsewhere along the river. So I guess, the motto is get protection, get together, band together, fight back, and you'll get the same kind of protection Camp Paradise gets. But in any case, the proposal that was originally put forward by Ed Porter, council member, to set up a headquarters for this Santa Cruz Service Corps down there at River and Coral Streets, so close to the Homeless Services Center, what some call the Homeless Services Center ghetto in the Harvey West Park area, and also to investigate campsites. I guess it got modified into being three parks, Harvey West, Lower De La Vega, and the San Lorenzo Benchlands. Is still not on the city council agenda, but there is a long missive from Tom Shaver and I presume Paul Lee, which goes out and has sort of requesting people to support the Camp Paradise proposals, and even a new proposal that the camp itself move to Highway 1 and River Street. I'm sorry, to River Street and Coral Street. This is, as I read it, the seems to be a proposal that's being put forward that it kind of be near the Homeless Services Center, which seemed a little strange to me because I know Camp Paradise wasn't, when I talked to them, interested in this proposal in being so close to the Homeless Services Center, because there was they place a lot of emphasis on being clean and sober, at least not abusing drugs and alcohol in the camp, and being so close to an area where drugs are used and sold in spite of the official policy, as you know, is always the case. You know, you have a large black market always going on when drugs are criminal and there aren't adequate treatment services and people are unhappy and unhoused and so forth. It's not something that Camp Paradise wanted. They were quite, at least the folks I talked to down there, including Camp Paradise founder Larry Templeton, he was very outspokenly hostile to it. Now, it may be that with everything else cut off, because locating Camp Paradise into Harvey West Park or into San Lorenzo Benchlands or into De La Vega is probably going to result in howls of outrage from a few neighbors, at least, there's always this reaction to homeless services when they come into areas, and even more so a campground, which would be particularly a homeless-run campground. So even though it's been successful in places like Portland, Oregon, and in where Dignity Village has been going for almost a year now, in fact, now 11 months, and Share, the Seattle campground, has been moving for a couple of years now, and they've been successful. It's bigotry, it's prejudice, it's fear, it's ignorance, but it's still there. So it's going to be hard to locate the campground in any of those parks, so maybe what they're trying to do is put it on top of this, into this building, which is ultimately going to be demolished and turned into a family shelter. And that's what I've heard, I believe what I've read on the internet. I like to see all possibilities explored, and I wonder what the staff is finding out. They're supposed to be researching the park areas, and they would have been researching the Greenbelt and the Pogonip, Arena Gulch and the Pogonip and other areas, but the habitat environmentalists, as I call them, folks who, I call them posies, not people environmentalists, who don't want to even consider the possibility of a temporary campground on any of the sacred Greenbelt areas. Turned that idea completely down, and I'm talking here people that I haven't spoken to Celia Scott. She didn't return my call. I called her a week and a half ago and trying to put together an article on the subject. I did put together an article, and it's in the current Street Spirit. It's actually 3 weeks ago, I think I called her, or more. And similarly with Bruce Van Allen, he didn't return calls. And Patricia Matichek is pretty clear about her position. She's on SLURP, San Lorenzo Urban River Project, as well as other environmentalists who don't get the so high profile. And it's wrong simply to attack these people as, you know, the evil geniuses. But they represent a body of opinion that I think is prejudiced, uninformed, and also using power politics. They're not engaging in an open public discussion in a reasonable fashion. They don't talk at city council at the mic. Instead, they talk to city council members privately. And they exert pressure on Crone, Sugar, Fitzmaurice, and Riley to do their little dirty work, which means not simply turning down the Pogonip as a campsite, but turning down an investigation, which wouldn't cost much. They don't mind spending millions of dollars to restore the Pogonip clubhouse, but they don't want to spend a couple hundred bucks of staff time looking into a survival campsite that could actually help the environment, because these folks will be working to restore it. It's a serious failing in our so-called progressive environmentalists so far, and they also don't want to talk about it. They're invited to call onto the show. They don't call. They don't talk. they keep a low profile because they're in power. And if you're in power, you don't have to talk. You just let the politicians do what they do. Let the police do what they do. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. There is a city council meeting, by the way, coming up fairly soon. It is next Tuesday, actually, 2 days from today. It's a special council meeting at 1:30 of the Redevelopment Agency. And what does that mean? That's the agency that handles affordable housing projects in the city. And, of course, the big project coming back is, again, that great albatross that's going to be dragging down the homeless. Well, it's going to—I believe in effect it'll be creating more homeless people, because it'll be siphoning off all the affordable housing funds for the next 5+ years. The Dolphin Lee project, the Dolphin Lee folks got a demolition permit. The Mercy Charities Housing, as to say, the cover group got a demolition permit, quickly rubber stamped by the city council last Tuesday, and we're going to hopefully hear an update on that from activist Becky Johnson, who I'm calling even as I speak. She was there speaking about the issue, as was I, and another activist, Ed Davidson. We'll see if we can actually get her on the phone here.
Becky Johnson.
Speaking.
You're live on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Imagine that.
Yeah. So I know that you have been poring over the documents. I've been talking a bit about the what happened last Tuesday at City Council. You want to kind of update us on what's been happening? I know that you did a forum on the Dolphin Lee about, last November?
A year ago, October.
October, right.
Mm-hmm.
And then in November, the Dolphin got purchased by the Mercy Charities Housing, essentially with money from the city. And what's happened since?
Well, at Tuesday's City Council meeting, the council voted to... that they're going to destroy the Dolphin and the Lee apartments, and they're planning on submitting the necessary relocation plan at this coming Tuesday City Council meeting, which is a step that we're kind of wondering how they're going to find housing within the limits
be
suitable.
Wait a minute, Becky. I looked at these papers that you I guess have been poring over. I didn't hear it was a relocation plan. I heard it was a sort of an operation. I'm not quite sure what actually it is they're doing, but a relocation plan would have a listing of all the different places that people are going to be relocated to. And is that in any of the documents?
Yeah, I don't really see that in the documents, mm-hmm. but it was mentioned by Cecil Cirillo, I think on a question by Council Member Mark Premack. He asked... how far along they were, how many people needed to be relocated, what the costs were, what the logistics of it were.
And whether they're going to do the leapfrogging. But let me just...
And Cecil said that she would take care of that at this upcoming meeting.
Well, we're talking about a project that involves several hundred people, at least in the Beach Flats area, down about a half a block from the boardwalk.
Yeah, according to documents, 250 people.
Mm-hmm. Which is actually considerably less than... You and I had predicted back a year ago. We predicted around 400 people. Were our predictions exaggerated? What do you think?
Well, of course, the population fluctuates somewhat. There's a seasonal fluctuation in the Hispanic community, and so it certainly was up to that during the summer months, in which spring and summer months when we were working with Residentes Unidos. But actually, this 250 is up from what they were saying when the property was purchased last November, when they were saying there were 165 people at the Dolphin, and that's if you count in what...
I think about 60 or 70 people at the Lee is what the number I got eventually out of the Lee.
Right, so 250 is a little bit closer to realism than what they were saying earlier.
Mm-hmm. So, of course, I know that we've all expressed a number of concerns. Why didn't they build on vacant property?
Why did Mercy Housing California have a sole source agreement with the city?
Right, with no other builders being considered.
Mm-hmm.
Questions like why aren't they doing things like this leapfrogging proposal, which is instead of spending all this millions of dollars relocating people in a way that may not even be possible, because I guess they're anticipating now a year to a year and a half for rebuilding time?
Well, it says that the construction has to, from a certain date, they have to complete construction in 24 months.
I see. So two years maximum,
right.
of relocation money would be might be as much as $1,000 a person per month, if you consider that the income that they can afford to pay is what, a couple of $100s, and an appropriate apartment would be $1,200, or am I up there too much? Are my figures too inflated? What do you think probable relocation costs would be to the taxpayer for this proposal, if you're talking about 250 people?
Well, I haven't crunched the numbers for 250, but Elizabeth Vogel did say it at a meeting much earlier.
She's a Mercy Charities Housing Executive Director or Funding Director or something.
Talking up to $45,000 per household.
Per household?
Per household.
Per month?
No, that would be like, $1,000 per month for 42 months. $42,000.
So $42,000, and how many households and 250 people?
I figure 3.5 per household probably.
So we're figuring about 70 or 80 households, and that would be let's extreme. If you call it 100 households, $45,000. That's $4,500,000, maybe less. Let's say $3 million relocation funding.
Well, they had said $2 million for relocation funding,
mm-hmm.
And that's crept up to $225,000 in this document.
And the significant thing here, it seems to me, to give people the bigger perspective, is I've heard it said, now is this true, this is all the affordable housing money available for the next 5 years for all projects, so essentially this one project is going to eat up everything?
Well, yeah, and it seems like, they said $12.7 million last November 13th.
For what?
For the cost of the project. On this document for Tuesday, now it's $12.8 million.
Mm-hmm.
And it also says, but that doesn't include land acquisition and demolition costs.
And they don't give you an estimate on the demolition costs?
Well, I did find them in another document. That's $64,000.
Mm-hmm. That's sort of a drop in the bucket.
That's a pittance for... Mm-hmm. But the land acquisition.
It's $2.5 million or something.
No, it's $3.4 million.
Uh huh.
And the 12.8 is what they say it costs. And if we add in the land acquisition, that's $16.2 million.
And how much is left for other housing projects?
I don't think there'll be anything left. They're not even going to really have enough money to fund this. They're going to still have to go out and do grant writing and probably private donations to really fully fund this project.
Well, but you were in the audience.
Especially if they want the recessed windows that the zoning department was concerned about.
Now, if you were in the audience when this thing came up last Tuesday, there were a lot of the folks that were opposed to this project from the Residentes Unidos seem to be supporting it now. Are you now going to simply pitting yourself against the residents? What's your situation?
Well, you know, if I was going to get a $260,000 apartment for one-third of my income, and my income was very low, you know, like $1,200 or $1,500 a month, you know, I'd be in favor of that project, too. And it's not like I begrudge the people in the Dolphin Lily good housing. My arguments have always been that we're not getting our bang for our buck. We're not increasing the affordable housing stock because we're destroying more units than we're actually building.
Now, wait a minute. They claim that they are building
more bedrooms.
Three or four times as many, or at least two or three times as many bedrooms as currently exist, and at least as many units as exist.
Well, first off, they're not counting the Rex Court units, which were already demolished, so that's 15 units. So it was really 63 units.
And we're actually talking there were three buildings, Rex Court, Dolphin and Lee apartments.
Right.
Dolphin and Lee are still standing. The Rex Court was demolished back in November without a demolition report or a report that they couldn't be refurbished, at least not a written report. It was quickly done right before the election, as I remember,
These are much bigger. I mean, the Dolphin and the Lee are basically remodeled motel rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So they are small.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true that this project, because it's going up in places as high as four stories, which I'm kind of surprised at. I thought that there were more strict height requirements in in the city. I thought there was a pretty strictly enforced two-story level, except in the downtown area. Mm-hmm. It is true that there are more bedrooms. There'll be 132 bedrooms mm-hmm. in the completed project, and there are currently 49 in the remaining Dolphin and Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So if you count in the Rex Court, another 15, you're basically doubling the number of bedrooms. Of course, I don't know how big they are, too.
Mm-hmm.
They could be not that large.
Well, so here are all these residents. They're being, you know, I mean, it seems to me that aren't you shifting the grounds of your objections a year ago or a year and a half ago? You and I, in fact, we're complaining about there not being guarantees for the people to return.
Well, Robert, according to these documents, they say there are only 28 households that have expressed an interest in wanting to be in the new new unit.
Wow. Only 28 households, so that's only about
households.
That's only about 100 people at most, huh?
Yeah, that's not going to be too hard for Mercy to manage. And, of course, we're at least, you know, 2 years or more away from when they're going to actually get in.
So in essence, what's going to happen is, as in fact both of us predicted, this will destroy the existing community of people, unless you consider these 28 households are the core of the community, and perhaps they are, who currently live in the Dolphin and Lee, and who are going to be, well, now the question is, are they being forced out, or are they just choosing to, you know, there's, I guess they're being bought out.
According to Elizabeth Vogel, several of the tenants have opted to take the 5,250 buyout to give up any claim on the new house.
Did she give any figures as to how many that is?
I was trying to. I had asked that question the redevelopment agency last Tuesday morning. I said, "How many people have taken advantage of that option and gotten? And you know, what is the total so far?" And they haven't gotten back to me about that yet.
Uh-huh. Well, perhaps next Christmas they'll get back to you.
Perhaps.
Now you.
There was another thing that concerned me in the document. They're saying that the apartments are affordable for 60 years, and I could have sworn I heard Elizabeth Vogel say that they're affordable in perpetuity. Those seem different to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at it another way. I mean, you and I oppose this, as a number of us oppose this project, not because, as was implied at the Tuesday session, that we're against affordable housing, but because we thought it was a waste of money in terms of really economical expansion of affordable housing, because it didn't provide protection for all the tenants, and because it didn't provide adequate relocation. Now, it looks now like it's been stated that relocation is, if it's only going to be relocating 28 or 38 families, 39 families.
27 households say they want the new housing. That's what my notes say.
If it's only 27 households, that may not be so hard to relocate as we had thought when we thought there were 400 people that were going to be relocated. So that concern may be gone. If those people are going to be allowed back in, and notice they say their priorities are assuming no serious felonies and income continues to be met, they will allow people in with you know, those who have lived there before as the first priority, second priority, beach flats, third priority, people who live and work in the Santa Cruz community. Am I accurate on that?
I think a lot of the people that were in the original Dolphin and Lee are already gone.
But, I mean, are they gone because they would have left anyway, or are they gone because they were pressured to leave? I mean, do we have any real evidence that they were pressured to leave?
I think that there were a lot of people who were not on the leases that were actually living in those buildings, and when Mercy took over, that they had to leave for one reason or another.
Well, it sounds to me like you're speculating because
I am.
Yeah, well, you got to be careful about that, because when I talked to a tenant who had been kind of, a lot of people were, I think, shepherded to the city council meeting by the Mercy Charities Housing / Redevelopment people last Tuesday to support the project. You know, they've been kind of, you know, they're on little committees and so forth, and I think that it's, I'm skeptical and somewhat cynical of their participation, because I think they're being, you know, encouraged to do this as a token thing rather than as any meaningful and real participation. But again, I don't have
too
a
bad,
lot of information on this. Let me finish this, and I'll be happy to let you respond. But the fellow I talked to, who actually told me that 30 people had bought it, had taken the buyout that he knew of. He said he was not on the lease, and he'd lived there, and he did not want to be publicly to go public, but he didn't mention he'd heard of anybody being evicted or anybody being turned away. So, and I have not either. So I want to give credit to Mercy Charities Housing and Elizabeth Vogel and the management there for, as far as I know, not evicting people. So,
well, one thing, you know, I know Mercy does is they'll put little notices up in the washroom, in the mail room, and the community room that say, oh, by the way, and it'll have something like, you know, tricycles are now banned from the property, and just reminding you that violation of this is a lease violation and can result in the revocation of your lease.
Now, is this stuff that you've heard about happening in the Dolphin and Lee, or at
other? That was another
Sycamore Grove or Lanieri Lagoon.
Sycamore Commons.
Sycamore Commons. Sorry.
But which is also managed by the same organization.
Right. So I'm just. You haven't.
So, I mean,
you
know, all they have to need to do is put up a little notice and say, oh, by the way, you know, if you, we remind you that you're only allowed to have, you know, a guest like one night.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're there two nights, then you have to get permission from the management. So on their second, and by the way, you know, if you don't follow this rule, we can revoke your lease.
Of course, there were previous rules being used by Maria Gutierrez in the Dolphin that resulted in a number of complaints from tenants to organizations like the Western Service Workers Union about ranging from unwillingness to deal with defective wiring and bad showering and other you know, serious, significant, if not, I don't know if they were fatal, but significant
mm-hmm.
habitability deals, to, you know, extra late fees that they were being charged. And these were concerns
mm-hmm.
that, you know, and they weren't being forced, to pay additional rent, as, for example, has happened in the Gutierrez property at 204 Riverside, where they doubled the rents. But they were getting some, you know, having some problems with the management. And I understand Mercy has been pretty good about this. In fact, they've lowered the rents, and they've been willing to make reasonable repairs. What's your understanding about this?
I do know, I did ask Maria about both of those concerns, and she said...
Maria Gutierrez. Former manager of the Dolphin.
Yeah.
When it was not Mercy Charities.
There was a dispute because they had, a part of their lease with the tenants was that if the drains were blocked or plugged,